I love the song that we just sang, and it ties in very well with our lesson tonight and with the series of lessons that we're going to be doing on Sunday evenings, where we're looking at the heavens and the earth. And we're looking at what God created in the creation that we see all around us, and we'll be talking about God's creation in general, like that God created all things, but then also specifically looking at different aspects of it on each Sunday night. And some of them, there is just a tremendous amount of biblical information on that we're only going to be able to kind of like scratch the surface on Sunday night. Some of them I think we'll be able to get a little bit more comprehensive, but some of them, like the one tonight, there is so much in the Bible. It's an extraordinarily commonly used word. It's used in the very first verse of the Bible, and it is used throughout, and it refers to a lot of different things. And so as we talk about our topic tonight, we're going to kind of sketch some of the ways that the Bible talks about this, but I won't be able to answer every question, but it'll be something that you could probably do an entire series on. And that is the word heavens. Tonight we're going to be talking about the heavens aspect of God's creation. So when I say the heavens, or when I say heaven, you know, in English we often use it singular. When I say something about heaven, what immediately pops into your mind? Probably something like where God is, or where we'll go for eternity. Those are often the ideas that we generally associate with heaven. Genesis 1:1 begins, "In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth." It starts off talking about the heavens, and then throughout the Bible, like so many things are referenced by the heavens. Jesus and his ministry, I think, could be well summarized in talking about the good news of the kingdom of heaven, or the heavens, plural. What Jesus preaches, it's about the kingdom of heaven, or the reign of God from heaven. What God created, it's the heavens and the earth. One of the difficulties as you approach the study of the word heaven or the heavens in the Bible is that we do tend to immediately think about it possibly or probably differently than early Christians and Jews when that word is used. So when I think of heaven, or, you know, like I just said, we immediately associate it with like the dwelling of God. And that's in the Bible too. Like that God, heaven is described as the dwelling place of God. That is a general term for it. But in English, we have a word for the dwelling place of God, which is heaven or the heavens. And we have a different word for like outer space. We have a different word for the sky or the skies. We have different words for these different like aspects of creation. In the Bible, the word in Hebrew, shemayim, is the word for like all of that stuff. It's like when you talk about God being in heaven, it's just the same thing as God being in the sky. And that's not how we tend to think of it. We think of, well, no, God is like in an immaterial realm, that is a different dimension or something like that. But it's not just like the sky. But in the Bible, that is the word heaven. The word heavens just means sky. And so in Genesis 1:1, when it says, "In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth," it's just saying he made the sky and the land, basically. Even that phrase, as we think about it, my first thought, when I think about the heavens and the earth, is I think of the earth as this planet that's like, I'm picturing it from images I've seen of satellites in the sky that have taken it where you see this blue ball floating around. If they're reading, "In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth," they're not thinking about what the heavens and the earth look like from a satellite from 1,000 miles away or something. They're thinking about what the heavens and the earth looks like from where they're standing. Like, that's the only way they've ever seen it. They've seen the heavens, which is everything up there, and the earth, which is everything down here. And so when they use the word the heavens, they're just talking about the stuff above their head, you know, what's way up there. And so that's the word that they use for where the birds fly. Where do they fly? They fly in the heavens. That's the word that they use for where the sun and the moon and the stars are. Where are they? They're in the heavens. That's the word that they use for where God is. Where is God? He's in the heavens. Although, as we'll see, I think their more literal usage of the word is for where the birds and outer space and planets and stuff like that is. I think when they speak of God being in the heavens, that's something of a more metaphorical use of the word. Because even the skies, and there are a couple of passages that demonstrate this, even the heavens can't contain God. Like even the sky itself is vast and as wide and majestic as it is. God is higher than even the highest heaven. We'll look at that phrase here in just a little bit. So that is the word that's used, but even that seems to fail to fully grasp the fact that God is not even limited to the heavens or to heaven. God is all places. God is specially in the heavens. God is also specially in a couple of unique places on earth, like Eden or the temple or the tabernacle or the burning bush. Like every once in a while, there's a sacred place on earth where God's presence seems to be experienced in a more full way. But then there's also just the general truth that no matter where I am, that's where God is. Psalm 139, it's like, if I'm up on the highest mountain, God is there. If I'm in the depths of Sheol, God is there. No matter where you are, no matter where you find yourself, you can't escape God. So where is God? Well, he's in the heavens, but he's also on the earth. He's also inside of you. He's also everywhere. Like, there is no place where there is not God. And so that's an important idea as well. And so when you speak of God being in heaven or in the heavens, I think a lot of times that's kind of metaphorical language that if you were to ask an Israelite, okay, so God is up there, right? And they say, yeah. Like, is he literally up there? Like he's in a body up there somewhere, or he's limited? And they say, well, no, I think he's actually everywhere, but we often speak of him as being, you know, up there. That's the language that we use. And so there are just some different nuances when we speak about, like, heaven. We have a specific word for where God is, and we call it heaven. But that word that they would use is also the word for, like, everything that's up there. So we subcategorize it a little bit differently than they do. But anyway, what we're going to see is how in the Bible that word is often used. And one thing that you might have noticed is I keep switching between singular and plural. And a lot of times that's what we do. You talk about the heavens, plural, you're talking about like the sky and all of that stuff. If you talk about heaven, singular, you're talking about where God is. But I don't think that's actually an accurate, like biblically accurate distinction there. In fact, in Hebrew, the word is always plural. There is no singular for it. It's just a plural word. And we don't, I was listening to something not long ago that was talking about that. Someone even asked the question. They were talking about this very idea that the word is always plural. And they were trying to think of English equivalents. And there are some English words that we just don't have a singular for, like the word scissors. You know, it's like, you don't, if you're asking for one, you don't say, hey, hand me a scissor. You know, that's like, it's they're scissors. Or glasses that someone wear. I mean, there is glasses a singular word. But if you're talking about spectacles, you know, we use the word glasses. And you know, they use it as a plural word. Clothes or shorts or pants. Or there are some things like that that are just always plural, even if you're talking about one. Well, heavens in Hebrew is just a plural word, always. In Greek, so that's when you get to the New Testament, it's primarily plural. There are a couple, it can be a singular word in Greek, but most of the time, it's plural, even though your Bible doesn't usually translate it as plural. So when Jesus preaches the kingdom of heaven, it reads singular in your Bible, but it would be something like kingdom of heavens, which would be something like the kingdom of the skies. You know, it's like, that's what the word means. And so all of that is a way to say that there's a, even just anytime you read the word, it might be putting a different thought into your head than it would be the earliest readers of the original language. But what we're going to do is we're going to read through several passages of Scripture. We'll be flipping around a little bit here tonight just to see some of the ways that in the early, in Israel mind and the early Christian mind, these words are used and how it might influence the way we think about God as we step outside and look up to the skies or the heavens. So Genesis chapter 1 and verse 1, very first verse of the Bible. This is how you can tell it's an important theme. It's like the very first thing you read in the Bible is about God creating the heavens. Genesis 1:1, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Now, I think that that verse is an introduction to what's about to follow. I think that verse is saying, all right, in the beginning God created, and I'm about to tell you how he did it. And then when you get to chapter 2 in verse 1, that's the conclusion. So these are bookend verses. So if you get to chapter 2 in verse 1, after he finishes these 6 days, he says, and "Thus the heavens and the earth were finished." And then notice the phrase, "and all the hosts of them." So the first chapter of Genesis is about how the heavens and the earth were created and filled with all of these different hosts or bodies or persons that are in there. And so as you read through it, you'll see that, like, we might think, well, he created the heavens and the earth in chapter 1 and verse 1, and then he created light, and then he did all these things. But notice the creation of light is day 1. The thing that he calls the heavens is day 2, and the thing that he calls the earth is day 3 as he's creating. So as you go through, this is about the creation of the heavens and the earth. So again, that creates a little bit of confusion because, like, well, if you look at chapter 1 and verse 2, before he creates the thing that he calls the earth, it says the earth was formless and void, and there was darkness over the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the waters. So the earth is there in some sense in Genesis chapter 1 and verse 2. It just is dark and covered in waters, and it's tohu vabohu is the Hebrew phrase, but formless and void or waste and wild is one translation. It's basically uninhabitable and useless earth. And what God does is he takes it and he makes it into something productive and beautiful and functional and something where the hosts can flourish within it, whether you're talking about humans or animals or the fish or the birds or even the stars in the skies of the heavens. And so what God does is he makes it all useful. He gives space and area. He gives location. And then he fills it with all of this wonderful stuff. And so chapter 1 and verse 3 is day 1, where God starts taking this uninhabitable, chaotic earth and starts making it into something functional and useful. Verse 3 says, "And God said, let there be light. And there was light. And God saw that the light was good." And then notice the phrase, "And God separated the light from the darkness." Now, how do you separate light from darkness? There's a couple of options. You could, just take the light and move it way over there, and so that the darkness is just what's left over here. Darkness isn't even a thing in and of itself. Darkness is just the absence of light. And so you could separate it by space, I guess, but that's not actually what God does here. God doesn't just move the light to one location and the darkness to a different location. The way that God separates the light and the darkness is by time. Sometimes there is light, and sometimes there is darkness. And that's actually what you get on day 1. You get God creating light, but what that light actually is it's time. That's why it says he separated the light from the darkness. And then notice verse 5. "God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. And there was evening and there was morning, a first day." So the way that what God does with light is he makes day. So the word light and the word day are not synonyms. Like it is light during daytime, but it's also light when you have a fire or a light bulb or like a lot of things that can create light. But what we're talking about in Genesis 1 is something that is creating a time period of light and that's separated from a time period of darkness. So I think what you're ultimately getting is light and darkness. This is really important, by the way, because once you get to day 4, he's going to do a little bit more with this light and darkness and this idea of time, and it'll relate really strongly to what we're talking about with the heavens. But just notice that day 1, you are getting light, but in essence, what you're getting is time. So then you get to day 2, and notice verse 6. "And God said, let there be an expanse," is one translation, or "a canopy" is another translation, or "space" is another translation, or "firmament" is another translation. This is a Hebrew word, rakia, and it's not a word that we actually know exactly what it means, and that's one of the reasons you get a lot of different translations of it. If you read any commentary on Genesis, they have to spend time talking about this word, and some people there's different views about whether it seems to be something solid, whether it seems to be just like the space in between what's up there and what's down here. But you get something called an expanse. And it says, let this there be an expanse in the midst of the waters. So if you remember, there's like the darkness in the waters when God says, let there be light. Well, now he's going to do something with the waters. He says in verse 6, "And let it separate the waters from the waters." And God made an expanse and separated the waters that were under the expanse from the waters which were above the expanse. And it was so, and God called that expanse heaven. And there was evening and there was morning a second day. So this is the day that God makes what he calls heaven, or the heavens, plural. And so what does he do? Well, there's this water down there. And so he takes the water and he separates it so that there's some water way up there and there's water down here and there's something in the middle of it. And whatever is in the middle of it, he calls heavens. So that's our earliest description of what the heavens are. It's the space between us and the water way up there. How do we know there's water way up there? Well, again, whether you're talking about science or like the ancient mindset or the, either way, we can all agree there's water up there because water comes down from up there. So whether you're talking about atmospheric or whether you're talking about a big pool, like there's debate about exactly what the ancient mind's conception of waters up there were. But the reality is if water can fall from up there, there's water up there, regardless of how you want to think about it. But day two is creating what is called the heavens, and that separates the water down here from the water up there. Day three, we won't talk about as much, but day three, basically, he goes back to the waters that are down here, and it says he separates them or he moves them so that dry land appears. Notice it's kind of interesting. He doesn't actually like create dry land. He just moves the water so that the dry land that's underneath it appears, or maybe he lifts up the land so that it appears above the waters. But the idea that you're getting here is now there's dry land, and he calls earth. So day two is the heavens, and day three is the earth. And then he makes that earth productive to where now there's trees and things like that and producing fruit and food on this earth. And so we have a productive, useful earth. We have a heavens. But do you know what we don't? And we have light for day and night and for evening and morning. But do you know what we don't yet have? We don't yet have the hosts that are filling those things. We don't have animals. We don't have birds and fish. We don't have the stars and the sun and the moon. We don't have humans yet. So this is, the first 3 days are the creations of the heavens and the earth. The next 3 days are the creation of the hosts that fill them. And that's what Genesis 1, or chapter 2 and verse 1 says. Thus the heavens and the earth were finished, and all the hosts of them. So now we're about to get to the hosts. So if you remember day one, God said, let there be light. Look at chapter 1 in verse 14. This is the beginning of day 4 now. It's going to connect directly to day 1. And it says, God said, let there be lights. So he's already said, let there be light, but now he's going to make the word light plural and say, let there be lights. And it's actually, this is interesting, it's a slightly different Hebrew word for light than that first one is. The first one is the word that's most commonly just generally used for light. But this one right here is used primarily to talk about two different things, and we're going to talk about this here in a little bit. One of those things are like the lights of the heavens, like the stars and the sun and the moon and things like that. And the other place that it's used is in the construction of the tabernacle, the menorah and the lights that are put in there. Those are like the starry heaven lights, but they're in the tabernacle. And that's going to be an important point as we go through this lesson, but right here, what he says is, let there be lights. And then he says in verse 14, these lights are in the expanse of the heavens. So he created the heavens and from the expanse. Well, now there's lights in the expanse of the heavens. And he says, they are to separate the day from the night. So remember, God already separated light from darkness, and the light he called day and the darkness he called night. Well, now he's putting hosts or objects in the expanse, in the heavens, and they have a job. Their job, they have a role in God's creation, which is to consistently separate. So this is like the organization of time, so that you have these hosts in the heavens above that separate light and darkness so that there's an organization and a system to it. When you look at verse 14 as it continues, it says, and let them be for signs and for seasons and for days and for years. And let them be lights in the expanse of the heavens to give light to the earth. And it was so. And God made two great lights, the greater light, which we usually call that the sun, even though the word sun isn't used here. There's a greater light to govern the day and a lesser light to rule the night. Notice that these lights are given actual jobs, ruling. They rule in the heavens. It's interesting because something else is going to be created to rule here later in this chapter, and it's us. God creates man in his image, and they rule what's taking place on the earth. The animals, and they're supposed to be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth. They're supposed to rule over the different animals that God made. But here is what he creates to rule or to govern the heavens. And that is what, like, the greater light and the lesser light are doing. And so this becomes interesting, and we'll talk about it, but the heavens have a ruler or a governor. And that's what the sun and the moon, that's what those things are doing. Now, in an ancient context outside of Israel, often those great lights were worshipped as though they were gods because they had this job of ruling, you know. Your day started when that big light told you it started, you know, so that thing was kind of in charge. But what we're getting in Genesis is that those things, while they have an important task and job, they are simply obeying what the ultimate creator has created them to do. So he's the creator of them, and he's the one who gives them these jobs. And so when you look up into the sky and you see the sun rising, that's a reminder of the creative power, not of the sun, but of the God who created the sun. And when you see the sun setting and you see the moon up there, it's a reminder that God has given even the moon a task and a purpose in his creation. And so if you're looking for reminders of the creative power and majesty of God, you can look at the vast size of the universe and the vast size of our solar system. You can look at the sun and the organization. You think, wow, that's incredible. But don't let that cause you to then be thankful to the universe, the solar system, or the sun. Let those be something that echoes the glory of God into your heart so that that's what you end up giving praise and thanks to. That's one of the things that distinguishes the Genesis creation account from the creation accounts of their neighbors around them, is that the sun is not in and of itself a god. The sun is a ruler created by God to shine light on the earth and to help us govern time. Like, the sun has a vocation, but the vocation is to assist in God's creative effort in organization of the heavens and the earth. When you get to day five, it says in verse 20, "And then God said, let the waters swarm with swarms of living creatures, and let the birds fly above the earth across the expanse of the heavens. So God created the great sea creatures and every living creature that moves, with which the waters swarm according to their kind, and every winged bird according to its kind. And God saw that it was good." So if you remember day two, that's where you have the waters, and God takes some of the waters below, and he lifts them up above, and he calls that area in the middle the heavens, right? So what he's doing now is he's filling those with hosts. So he fills the waters with all of those animals, every living creature that's in the waters, and he fills the heavens with birds and all the winged creatures. And so again, you're getting the creation of the environment in the first 3 days, the heavens and the earth, and then you're filling them with hosts in the next 3 days. And so what are the heavens in Genesis 1:1, or in Genesis chapter 1? The heavens are the space in between earth and everything way up there. It's like all of that stuff up there is like the heavens. And what does God do with the heavens? Well, he fills it with these lights that govern what's going on earth, the time. He also fills it with living creatures, like the birds and the winged creatures. And so even with that, though, you're getting kind of different thoughts about heavens. Like there's where the birds are, which might be 30 feet above your head, but then there's also where the sun is, which is, I think, 93 million miles. I think I've heard that before. I didn't look it up. But so if I'm right, you should all be very impressed. But if I'm wrong, just forget about it. But anyway, very different distances, and yet they're all described in Genesis 1 as being what God is filling the heavens with. So the heavens are vast and great and mighty. And so as you read through, you see that God intentionally creates the heavens. He does so with living creatures. He does so with rulers that govern, which is the sun and the moon, and with stars. And all of these things are up in God's heavens. So what should you think about when you see the heavens? I want to read a couple of passages from the Psalms where you see Israelites doing that very thing. People who are familiar with these creation texts, when they see the heavens, they write a few things down. And those, I think, are helpful to us as we consider the majesty of God and what his creation reminds us about him. So look with me at Psalm 8 to start off. Psalm 8. It says, O Lord, our Lord, how majestic is your name in all the earth. You have set your glory above the heavens. And so even the idea of, like, when you look up there, you're seeing glory, but you're not even able to fully grasp the glory of God, which even exceeds the heavens. So as majestic and beautiful as all of that is, the glory of God exceeds even that. But when you get to verse 3, he says, when I look at your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars, which you have set in place, what is man that you are mindful of him, and the son of man that you care for him? Have you ever seen one of those videos? I actually watched one not long ago with my boys. But where it shows you, like, the unfathomable enormity of the world, but then, like, the solar system, and then the size of different stars and the different, like, it is incredible. It'll, like, start with one place on Earth, and it'll start zooming out, and it just gets bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, and you come to realize that our Earth is pretty big, and then you compare it to Jupiter, and it looks tiny, and then you compare Jupiter to the sun, and it's even tiny, and then you compare the sun to, like, another type of star, and it's insignificant, and then you compare it, like, there are stars that just absolutely dwarf the size of our sun, and then you get compare that to a black hole, and it's like, little by little, you realize, man, we are the smallest thing in the, like, that exists compared to the vast. And as you look at that, you might think, well, we must not matter at all then. But that's kind of I think it's an important reminder that how much space something takes up, the size of like a human being compared to an elephant, it doesn't mean that you're less important than an elephant because you're smaller. That's not how value is determined. And the same thing is true with the whole universe itself. It doesn't matter how small Earth is. That's not how value is determined. And that's really the question that when he says, when I consider, like, the vast majesty, glory, and beauty, when I consider the fact that the sun obeys God every morning and the fact that I don't, why is it that you care more about me? Like, what is man that you are concerned about him, or the son of man that you care for him? Yet you've made him a little lower than the divine beings. You've crowned him with glory and honor. You have given him dominion over the work of your hands. That's Genesis 1. Over the work of your hands, and have set all things under his feet, all sheep and oxen, all beasts of the field, the birds of the heavens, the fish of the sea, whatever passes through the paths of the sea, O Lord, our Lord, how majestic is your name in all the earth. So all the different hosts there, he's like, you've put all those things under man. What? And that's how the psalm ends. It's in essence a question about what it is about the fact that God has genuinely, truly chosen to love and care for humans. But it's rooted in the fact that God did. I mean, you see that in Genesis. After creating the glory of this creation, that's when God says, let us create man in our image to have him rule. And so Psalm 8, when you look at the glory and beauty of the cosmos, it's a reminder of not just the power and artistry of God, but also this powerful, majestic, glorious, artistic God knows you and loves you and has given you a place of prominence in this creation. It's a pretty powerful idea. And it's one that this psalm he's reveling in that fact. I want to look at another one. This is Psalm 19. Psalm 19. The first half of this psalm is talking about basically the sun and what you see when you look at the space that God has created, the heavens. And then it relates it to the Torah, like the word of God. But as you read through it, You see some beautiful things about what God has made. Psalm 19 and verse 1 says, the heavens declare the glory of God, and the sky above proclaims his handiwork. So you should be hearing a sermon from the sky and from the heavens every time you walk outside about the glory and handiwork of God. They are proclaiming and declaring these things. Verse 2, day to day pours out speech and night to night reveals knowledge. So speech and knowledge are being poured out as you look up above each day and each night. He says in verse 3, there is no speech, nor are there words whose voice is not heard. And so everyone can hear this message that is being proclaimed from the heavens above. Verse 4, their voice goes through all the earth and their words to the end of the world. In them, he has set a tent for his son. And again, I mentioned earlier about the tabernacle having the lights in it. And that's the same word that he uses for the lights above. He'll often actually refer to that firmament or the expanse or the heavens as like a tent or a tabernacle. That's a word that the Bible will repeatedly use. It'll say he stretched out the heavens like a tent. And so there's a strong connection between what's taking place in the tabernacle and the heavens above. But right here you see it even in this language where he says he has a tent for his son, which comes out like a bridegroom leaving his chamber, and like a strong man, it runs its course with joy. So the sun moves across the sky like a strong man who cannot be stopped, and he's doing so with joy. In verse 6, its rising is from the end of the heavens, and its circuit is like the end of them, and there is nothing hidden from its heat. And then he says, the law of the Lord is perfect, reviving the soul. And he begins to talk about the word and the law and the declarations of God. But I think the point is, in the same way that the sun is unstoppable, it has speech that everyone hears, people can see its glory, that's like what the word of God is. And so he uses the sun as a reminder of the word and the law of God and how it enlivens and enlightens it. In fact, he'll actually use the word enlightening the heart, enlightening the eyes in verse 8. He talks about the precepts of the Lord. They enlighten you. Well, that's what the sun does. And so he sees the sun as a reminder of the glory and majesty of God, but also of the certainty and the efficacy of God's words. There are other psalms you can go to see this type of artistic language, but it's all the way through. And so the heavens, in one sense, just means the skies. But the skies are shouting forth the glory of the God who created them, and they are a constant reminder of his glory, majesty, and beauty, the fact that he loves you, the fact that his word is eternal and true. And I think that's the type of thing you should think about, even when you read Jesus' words like, I am the light of the world. If you begin to associate Jesus with that creative light, the light that enlightens every man, every morning that you wake up and you see the sun rising, let that be a reminder of how the world was in darkness and Jesus, as the light of the world, came to enlighten every man. Last night, the world was in darkness, but this morning as the sun rose, the light came to enlighten every man. Like, it becomes a reminder of the gospel story itself. And I think that's why those types of illustrations are used, so that even if you don't have a Bible near you, the knowledge of God can pour forth through from the heavens. Or as Psalm 19 and verse 1 says, the heavens declare the glory of the God, and the sky above proclaims his handiwork. So there's that sense of the heavens being used. But the heavens are also used as the dwelling place of God in some unique, perhaps metaphorical sense. Look at Isaiah chapter 66 with me. And we're going to look at a couple passages a lot more quickly here. But in Isaiah 66, there's language used about God and his majesty, even in comparison to the heavens and the earth. Isaiah 66 and verse 1 says, thus says the Lord, heaven is my throne, and the earth is my footstool. What is the house that you will build for me, and where is the place of my rest? So the temple is considered to be the house of God, the place of God's rest. The temple was destroyed by Babylon. It had to be rebuilt. But notice the language there of, but there's not really actually a house that can in any real way house God, because what? He's too big. Like, the earth is where his feet are. And if you look up, like, even into the heavens, that's where his throne is. It's like he's so massive that he's everywhere, from earth even up to the highest heavens. And that is something that Solomon, with the dedication of the temple, is very much aware of. He makes the same type of language. This is in 1 Kings 8. After spending so much money and time and effort to build the most glorious and beautiful temple a human being could build, as he builds it, in the dedication of it, where he's explaining its purpose to the people, he immediately belittles it. Not because it's not impressive, but because in comparison to God, he recognizes that it's nothing. It's nothing. Like, and so this is what he says. This is 1 Kings 8:27. After building this incredible house, he says, "But will God indeed dwell on the earth? Behold, heaven and the highest heaven," or heavens and the highest heavens, plural, "cannot contain you. How much less this house that I have built? Yet have regard to the prayer of your servant and to his plea, O Lord my God, listening to his cry and to the prayer that your servant prays before you this day, that your eyes may be opened night and day toward this house, the place of which you have said, 'My name shall be there,' that you may listen to the prayer of your servant offered toward this place, and listen to the plea of your servant and of your people Israel when they pray toward this place, and listen in heaven, your dwelling place, when they hear, forgive." So the temple is the dwelling place of God. I mean, that's described in the Bible. But again, that's metaphorical, because even the temple, there's no way it could possibly house or contain him. But what Solomon says is even the heavens can't. Even the heavens, then he uses the language, and the highest heavens. So that might be saying something like, even where the birds fly, even where the stars and the sun and the moon are, they can't contain you. It's like, even if you say God dwells in heaven or the heavens, is inadequate to fully capture, because he's everywhere all at once, whether you're talking about the sky or whether you're talking about on earth below. And so what he says is, God, we've built this house for you. I know it can't contain you. I know even the heavens can't contain you, but have grace towards us and listen to the prayers that are offered here. Your dwelling place in the heavens, hear us and look favorably upon us from there. And that's, I believe, what God does. But any place on earth where God is specially seen to dwell, I think that does happen. There are places in the Bible that are described like that, whether you're talking about the burning bush or the tabernacle or the temple, you know, the Eden, the heavens. Those are all not denying the omnipresence of God, but they're showing certain areas where God's presence is experienced in more vivid ways than others. And that's not to say that God is more or less in any place, but I think it has to do with the human experience of God being more fully realized in certain locations. And the temple was one of those places. It was like the heavens above, there's a small place on earth where those dwell, and that's where you can find God in an intimate way. And so that type of language is used, but it does lead to the question, Paul uses language, and this is in 2 Corinthians 12, where he describes a man who he knew, seemingly himself, who went to the third heavens and saw a vision there. He says that whether it was in body or in spirit, I'm not actually sure. He doesn't know if he was actually there or if it was just a vision that he had. But he talks about it, and he learns that God's grace is sufficient for him, and he has a thorn in the flesh to keep him humble. But he uses the language of the third heavens. And so if the word heavens is generally always plural in Hebrew, it certainly is. What are the heavens? And again, this is kind of speculative because we actually don't know for certain, but something that I heard a long time ago, and I've never seen any compelling reason to think it's not likely, is that basically you have like the heavens of day 5, which is where the birds are flying. You have the heavens of day 4, which is where like the sun and the moon and the stars are. And then you have the highest heavens, or the third heavens, which is where God is and where God dwells. And so that might be kind of the language that Paul is using there of a spiritual reality where the presence of God is experienced in very vivid and real and in intimate ways. But even that, you know, one of the things that you see throughout the Bible is when you think of heaven, you shouldn't think of it as some distant, faraway place where it's hard for God to hear you. The heaven where God dwells if he does dwell in heaven, is all around us, just perhaps maybe invisible to us in the here and now. But the day will come, as we sang a moment ago, where that invisible realm will become our reality, and it will become one with us. But there is language that is used throughout the New Testament to describe heaven as God's dwelling place. Jesus, in this famous Lord's Prayer, "Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be your name, your kingdom come, your will be done, on earth as it is in heaven." And I think that phrase right there, "your will be done on earth as it is in heaven," is a really powerful description of what the kingdom of heaven is, like the reign of God. God reigns and rules in heaven where his will is done absolutely and perfectly. And the idea of the kingdom on earth is that we want earth to be a place where God's will is done. Think of all of the pains that are caused by sin and disease and death on earth. That's not God's will in heaven. So in the kingdom on earth, we want to see that type of experience here. That's why Jesus teaches against sin. That's why Jesus calls people to righteousness. That's why Jesus heals people. Like, that's why Jesus rises from the dead and even raises a few other people from the dead, because he's demonstrating what heaven on earth looks like. That's the reign or the rule of God on earth. That's the kingdom of God on earth. We're told things like, store up your treasure in heaven, because that's where God is. And so live now in such a way that what you're producing is being offered up straight to God, because he will secure it until that final day. And so heaven is the skies. Heaven is where God dwells. And I've made reference a number of times, but heaven is also seemingly experienced in certain unique places on earth, like Eden, or the burning bush, or the tabernacle. We can read through descriptions of the tabernacle. There's one passage I want to read quickly. It's from Isaiah chapter 40. And this type of language, we've already seen it in some of the Psalms. It's in other ones also. But where the heavens above are described as being like the tabernacle. In Isaiah chapter 40, verses 21 through 23, it says, "Do you not know? Do you not hear? Has it not been told you from the beginning? Have you not understood from the foundations of the earth? He who sits above the circle of the earth and its inhabitants are like grasshoppers, who stretches out the heavens like a curtain and spreads them like a tent to dwell in, who brings princes to nothing and makes the rulers of the earth as emptiness." Notice the language there of the curtain and the tent. He says, like, that's what the heavens are. And I think the picture is, you think that the tabernacle is where God dwells, and he does in a special, unique way, seem to be present there and experienced there in a really vivid way. But that tabernacle is just a small picture of what the heavens themselves are. And that's the point that Hebrews makes by, like, over and over again, that the tabernacle is a pattern that blueprints are designed from the actual dwelling place of God. And so Jesus was the true high priest who didn't go to the temple like the pattern. He actually went to the true dwelling of God, which is in the heavens above. And so the tabernacle and the temple are often pictured as representations of the presence of God, which is why a lot of the artistry in the tabernacle is the same artistry that is used to describe the heavens. Whether you're talking about the lights, which is the lights that God created for the heavens, is the same word that's for the lights in the tabernacle, or sometimes the colors of the tabernacle, like the dark blues and purples of the materials that are in there, might even look like the heavens sky, or the cherubim. A cherub is a type of animalistic creature that seems to dwell at the presence of the throne of God. And those are woven into the veil, and those are on both sides of the Ark of the Covenant, in the tabernacle and in the temple. It's like all of these things are vivid reminders of this room in this tent or this building being like a small sliver of heaven on earth where the presence of God resides. And that's why there are some interesting stories in the Bible that demonstrate the connection between the temple and the dwelling of God. For one thing, it's often called the house of God. There's a guy named Jacob, who in Genesis 28, he's fleeing for his life, and he falls asleep, and while he's sleeping, he sees the heavens open, and he sees this huge staircase that is ascending up into the heavens. And after that dream, he sees the angels ascending and descending on it and God standing at the top of it. And after that vision, he names that place Bethel, which means house of God. And one of the things that's really fascinating about that is in the Gospel of John, chapter 1, Jesus meets a guy named Nathanael and gives him a small demonstration of some of Jesus' prophetic vision. He says, I saw you while you were sitting under a tree. And Nathanael knew no one was around. He says, wow, you're the Son of God. You're the King of Israel. And Jesus says, you're that impressed by what you just saw? Behold, you will see greater things than these. You will see the Son of Man, or you will see the angels of heaven ascending and descending on the Son of Man. And what he does is he uses a phrase from that story of Jacob, the place where it's called the house of God, and he says, you know that ladder or that stairwell that connected heaven and earth that became the house of God, which is the language for the temple? That's what I am. If you're looking for the presence of God, you're not going to find it limited to the heavens. And you're not going to even find it limited to a building. If you want to see who God is, you look to Jesus or the Son of Man. And it's the next thing Jesus does. You know, he turns water into wine there in chapter 2. Then he goes to the temple. You know what he does while he's at the temple? He ends up flipping all the tables and people get really upset. They're like, what sign are you doing, you know, for this? And he says, destroy this temple and in 3 days I'll rebuild it. And they say, it took 46 years to build this temple. How are you going to rebuild it in 3 days? And we're told that he was speaking of the temple of his body. I think what that means is the temple, which represents heaven, is inadequate. Where the true presence and dwelling of God is, if you want to find the presence of God, if you want to find forgiveness, if you want to worship God, you go to Jesus, not a brick and mortar building. He's the living, breathing, walking, talking temple, which is also a way of saying he is the living embodiment of heaven on earth. The heavens are found in Jesus, and that's why when he preaches and proclaims the kingdom, the Gospel of Matthew uses the language, he's preaching the kingdom of the heavens. Like, that's what he's bringing to us. Jesus is where we find the heavens embodied in a person, where we find the presence and the dwelling of God in a man. And so, there's a ton that more that could be said about the heavens, but it's time for us to draw it to a close. And so, if you want heaven, right? Find it in Jesus. There is no greater place to go. And as you walk outside and as you look at the night sky, then as you look at the sunset, let that be a reminder each and every day of the glory, the artistry, the majesty of God, his love for you, his revelation of his word, and the person of Jesus who has come to be that living temple on earth and the one who can bring the presence of God to you in the realest way possible. If there's anyone here tonight who would like to become a Christian or would need the prayers of the church, please let that be known. Come sit on the front row while we stand and as we sing.